Jewish Education and Media is pleased to present L'Chaim, a program that highlights the people, issues, and events of importance to the Jewish community. Now here is your host, Rabbi Mark Golub.
I'm Mark Golub, and one of my favorite people in the Jewish world today is a man who is making a unique and vitally important contribution to Jewish life. He's a most thoughtful, committed Jew, and ohev Yisrael, a lover of Israel, in both meanings of the word Israel, the Jewish people and the state of Israel. He was born in the UK, made Aliyah, and served in the IDF during the Second Lebanon War of 2006, Operation Pillar of Defense in 2012, and Operation Protective Edge in 2014, serving on the West Bank and along Israel's northern border. For many years after his active service, he led an organization called Our Soldiers Speak, which he created to counter the vicious anti-Semitic canards and lies being told to college kids about the IDF. And he built Our Soldiers Speak into an international advocate for Israel, briefing the highest levels of American government and other government bodies throughout the Western world. His name is Benjamin Anthony. If you're a fan of JBS, you've seen him many times on with me and hosting his own series, Israel Briefing. But recently, Benjamin has reshaped the form in which he advocates for Israel with his newest nonprofit organization called the Miriam Institute. Why did Benjamin Anthony create the Miriam Institute? And what's its goal and its purpose? And what's his take on some of the sensitive issues challenging Israel and Jewish life today? For some answers, it's my enormous pleasure to welcome back to L'Chaim and JBS, my dear friend, Benjamin Anthony. Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you very much for having me again, Mark. I greatly appreciate you having me on your show. Thank you.
All right, Benjamin, before we talk about the Miriam Institute, I want to spend just a few moments talking about your background for those who may not have seen your first meeting with me on L'Chaim. I already mentioned you were born in England. Briefly, tell us what your life in the UK was like and tell us how you came to make Aliyah.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I do, I just want to thank you, Mark, because I don't know how aware of it your viewers are, but you very much mentored me in terms of the work that I undertake, including just before this conversation. Thank you so very much for continuing to apply your professionalism and talent and to share it with individuals such as myself and many, many more. And also, I want to thank you and your entire team over there for the incredible work you're doing to compile what I've said before, but I want to say again, in my view, is an invaluable archive of Jewish events that will enrich future generations of Jews and indeed generations of people not of the Jewish faith throughout the world. Thank you so very much for all you do. If there's a hot button issue, and I've seen you've ramped up your content even more of late, Mark, I know that I can turn to JBS for the best of that information. So thank you to you and to your team.
That's very, very kind of you. And coming from you, it means all the more. Thank you. All right. Tell the audience about your youth. And again, anybody who wants to know this in detail, they can go to an earlier edition of L'Chaim where Benjamin is my guest and we do an hour and a half. And it's a fabulous story and he does it in a lot of detail. I don't want detail this time because I want to talk about the Miriam Institute. But I do want you to tell enough so people understand what your life was like, who your father was, and then why you made Aliyah.
Absolutely. So, seminal aspects to my life growing up, born and raised in an Orthodox Jewish family in the northeastern city of Leeds, I am the son of the Chazan of one of the leading synagogues, the grandson of the Av Bet Din, the head of the rabbinical court in that city, very well-known individual in the United Kingdom. Also my mother, a pianist to my father's cantorial voice. And I'm one of seven children, six sons, one daughter. We were raised to be very proud of our Judaism. We were also raised to hide our Judaism for the most part in the public square because of anti-Semitism. So in brief form, that meant as young Jewish males wearing a baseball cap, not a yarmulke. At the age of 14, I saw my brother, my older brother, Jonathan, beaten almost to death by way of an anti-Semitic attack at 8:30 in the morning during the end phase of our commute to the Jewish high school that we attended. That attack was so severe that his health deteriorated and culminated in him undergoing three liver transplants in 1 week. And he's alive today, and he has a baby girl today, and he's married, and he works.
Mazal tov, that's fabulous.
Absolutely, but unfortunately, he's not known a day of full good health since that moment. And that was very, very jarring to me. So that was physical anti-Semitism.
And how did that event change you?
Well, it changed my life immediately. I think the most profound impact that it had upon me was that it converted me from being a child into an adult. It showed me that this idea of anti-Semitism that I was hiding from when wearing a baseball cap as a young child actually existed. It also turned me into an individual who had suffered anti-Semitism in a very, very brutal form. And it also brought about something of a wedge between the various siblings in the family, if I'm candid about it, not in terms of us not getting along or not being able to manage together, but there were two very distinct memories. There were four of the children who were present at that attack: Jonathan, me, Michael, and Rafi. And the other siblings, Jared, Lauren, and Alexander, were not present. And so there was always this divide when it came to dealing with the trauma, specifically on that issue. There were those who were there and understood what we'd gone through, and there were those who were there who were certainly sympathetic to it, but could never understand what we'd undergone and what had befallen us. And so I think that was a very profound impact. In addition to that, I became very, very interested in the notion of being able to defend myself and protect myself, which is quite a juvenile response to that. But in the long term, that experience has taught me that, in fact, the Jewish people entire must have a place in which they are defended and protected because they are Jewish, rather than in spite of the fact that they're Jewish. That's Israel. And as a direct result of that, I decided that I wanted to apply whatever I had to the defense of the state of Israel.
One last question, then we'll get to your moving to Israel, you're making Aliyah. Do you remember how your father reacted when he first learns of the beating that your brother took? And if it weren't for you, he might have been beaten to death. What did your father say to you and the other children? What did he say to your mother? The idea of having one's son beaten so mercilessly is troubling, whether it was anti-Semitic or not. Here it was anti-Semitic. Yeah. Do you remember anything about how your father reacted?
I do. It's very interesting that you ask that as well, because my father at that time was a practicing criminal defense attorney. And I remember, and I think it was at this incident, that we sat down with the police officers at some point along the way, not in the immediate aftermath, but some point along the way. And the police officer made a statement that was very discomforting to my father. He said, "Well, you live by the sword, you die by the sword." And what he was referring to was walking around identifiably as Jews. We had our blazers on, not a yarmulke on. And the blazer of the school had the emblem of the school on the breast pocket. And I remember my father said at the time, he's not going to pursue criminal proceedings to their full end. And he was right to do so, because ultimately the people who beat my brother, if memory serves, they were given a £200 fine to be paid off across a period of 2 years. So, you know, they'd almost killed a young man, and they were punished with something that was absolutely negligible. The other thing I remember distinctly about my father was that when he came to pick up Jonathan and drove him home, he actually had to brief my mother in advance of her seeing Jonathan. I do remember that quite distinctly because he was terribly swollen, he was terribly beaten, and it was really an awful sight.
All right, move from there to what motivates you now to make Aliyah.
So at the age of 18, Mark, I had decided that I wanted to join the Israel Defense Forces and to make Aliyah. But Jonathan was extremely unwell at that precise time. And so even though I'd started the paperwork, I personally was uncomfortable with the idea that I would be placing my mother in a situation whereby she had one son who was very, very unwell, and another son who was marching off into potentially very dangerous situations of his own volition. And in my own sense of compromise, I said, I will defer that. I'll go to university. And if during my studies, the desire to make Aliyah still burns, I will not delay that any further. I will graduate and then I will go. And in fact, not only did my desire to make Aliyah remain, but it intensified because I was at university during the events of the Second Intifada, which, as you know, was a wave of Palestinian homicide bombings that brought Israeli parents to a situation whereby they would divide their children up among different buses from the same destination to the same, from the same point of origin, rather, to the same destination and back again, with the macabre hope that if one child was blown apart by way of a homicide bombing on the bus, the other child might yet make it home safely. And I was a student campaigner, and I saw the uniformity that emerged in terms of public opinion from the professor to the student, and from the elected official to the voter, and from the professional to the layman, behind the idea that the state of Israel not only had no right to defend herself, but in fact was entirely responsible for the evil and the terror being wrought upon it and its citizens. And I, as I say, I was a student campaigner. I became very engaged with that, and daily, after we would do our level best to bring attention to our side of events as young Zionists, we would retire to a student house and we would talk about how we must make Aliyah. We had to not campaign and not stand on the union steps, but we actually had to move to Israel now, and we had to go and fight, and we had to go and serve and join our brothers and sisters in the Israel Defense Forces. And I was very, very moved by that, and I used to speak about that vigorously. Out of the cadre of people who discussed it, I can tell you that when finally we did graduate, to the best of my knowledge, I'm the only one who actually did move on that and make a direct beeline to the State of Israel. And then I enjoyed the privilege of serving and drafting, incidentally, beyond the age where I was eligible to serve. So there is a cutoff age at 23 for service. I was 24 or 25.
Yes.
And I made damn sure that I got into the Israel Defense Forces.
Okay. Now speak for, again, just a moment about what your experience was in the IDF in the various situations that I described. You were in really action after action after action, and you were on the West Bank, you were on the northern border. How would you describe the ethic of the IDF as it was communicated to you, and this is very important, Benjamin, how you saw it translated into day-to-day operations by ordinary Israeli kids from all over? Everybody understands Israel is a civilian army, and civilians come, whether Ashkenazic or Sephardic, from different stations in life, from different kinds of communities, even from different, quote, communities of Jewish observance. But you are now part of them. You are a hair older, but as you looked at both the theory of the ethic of the IDF and then the sociological reality of how did Israeli soldiers, these young kids, behave, how would you describe it?
So first of all, you're very generous describing me as a hair older. I can tell you that my contemporaries in the brigade that I served within called me Saba, which is granddad or grandfather or grandpa, whatever you translate it into.
You were hardly a Saba, but go ahead.
Right. So beyond everything else about ethics and activities and so forth, I just want to say it was the greatest decision of my life. And I would encourage anybody, if they're of a mindset, if they're struggling with the decision as young Jews, Zionists, whether or not to go and serve, I would strongly encourage you to go and do it, as long as it's for the right reasons. To give, not to take, to serve, not to embolden oneself, not to prove oneself, but in an act of humble service to the good of the Jewish people in the Jewish state. So I had a glorious service, a wonderful service, but the events that you recounted happened at various points during that. As a conscript, I was in the Second Lebanon War in 2006. That was a life-changing event. That was an event that I think personally showed me the ethic of the soldiers of the Israel Defense Forces, who knew when to engage and when to not, who clearly were different to many other soldiers in other democratic states. You know, in other democratic states, Mark, people choose to be soldiers. They elect to be soldiers for the most part. So an American soldier or a British soldier elects to become a soldier. And they do that for various reasons. Some do it for financial opportunities and grants to go on to university. Others do it to climb out of adversity at home. Others because they want to prove themselves. Others out of patriotic duty. There's no end to the range of motivations that a soldier has, but it is their choice. The Israeli soldier is an entirely different species of soldier. It's very important that people understand this, because the Israeli soldier is drafted straight out of high school at the age of 18. Some do a year of service prior to joining the IDF, but once they're done in high school, they are making a beeline for military service within the Israel Defense Forces. And with the exception of those who decide that they want to be officers, and those people, by the way, decide they want to be officers for the best reasons, again, to serve and to give and to contribute to the state of Israel, the vast majority of Israeli soldiers go into the military with one goal, and that is to navigate their way through 3 years of incredible dilemmas and to return to being civilians thereafter, in the case of male soldiers, and to return as civilians of good and clear conscience. And that ethos really governs everything that they do. That's why, incidentally, to come to a quick point, if I may, at a tangent, when I hear the BDS movement alleging that the horrific scenes that we saw with George Floyd were somehow taught to the Minneapolis police by the Israel Defense Forces or the Israel National Police, I can tell you that is an absolute canard, an absolute slander. Nothing could be further from the truth. And we have to fight back against these misrepresentations and these libels against the soldiers of the IDF regularly and often, unfortunately.
Yes, but I want to still push you.
Please.
I want you to describe for me what you saw. And I want to understand if from your perspective, because Benjamin, in the end, this is the argument. The argument is, don't tell me about the ethics in theory of the IDF. The critics of the IDF, the, you know, breaking the silence groups of IDF, former IDF soldiers, their argument is that regardless of what the theoretical ethic of the IDF is, on the ground, young kids are doing terrible things all the time. And I'm asking you, what did you see? You were there a long time. You were there in very different situations, and many of them were just horrific. War is horrific. Yeah. And most Americans have been graced with never having had to serve in the army. They don't know what war is like. Generation, at least two generations now, basically, of American Jews, we have no idea of what war is like.
Yes.
And there's nothing romantic about it. And it's, you know, a good movie is a good movie, but it's a movie. It's not real life. So I'm asking you, you were at checkpoints on the West Bank, and checkpoints get the worst reputation. We are told that Palestinians are regularly humiliated at checkpoints by young Israeli soldiers who just are doing it for sport. We're told that Israeli soldiers shoot four-year-old babies or arrest four-year-old babies just because they do it. Yeah. Now, I want to know from you, you've seen it.
course.
And again, people can say, well, what you're asking Benjamin Anthony, is that an objective observer? In many ways, Benjamin Anthony is about the best person you can ask. I want you to answer. I want you to talk to the audience about that. What did you see for yourself? And to what extent, again, is there a disconnect between the idealism of the ethic of the IDF and the sociological reality of young kids with guns facing people who they may not like at all?
Yeah, so let's start with checkpoints. I spent several months of my service in Hebron, which is a very, very complicated place to be a soldier in the IDF for various reasons. First of all, you're facing hostilities from different sides of the discussion and the debate. Secondly, you have international observers there. There is a massive, massive presence of international observers and frankly, agitators who are just waiting to find a soldier who acts in a manner that they deem untoward or unprofessional or whatever the case may be. You have the UN very, very heavily represented in Hebron. And also, unlike many other places where soldiers will serve, Hebron is one of those areas where you have Arab house next to Jewish house next to Arab house. It's very, very crowded in. And I actually stood for part of my service in Hebron at a checkpoint about 2 minutes walk from a base called Tel Romeda, which is right next to Kever Ishai, Jesse's tomb, for the viewers who may have been there. And regularly we hear the charge that, for example, the soldiers of the Israel Defense Forces will hold up pregnant women at checkpoints egregiously, for no reason whatsoever, that somehow they will humiliate them, that they'll make them stand in the sun, that they'll do any number of things. Now here's the reality of what happens. When people move from the Palestinian Arab areas into the Jewish areas, they have to go through a metal detector. This metal detector, incidentally, looks very much like the metal detector we used to walk through before COVID-19, when we would fly to various destinations in an airport, the one that we go through with the TSA looking at us. Now, it became apparent that those metal detectors had the potential to be harmful to the fetus of a pregnant woman, right? So that was what became very, very apparent. It didn't mean it always was, but there was the potential for it. Now, Islam, for those who are observant, is rather similar to Judaism. Islam, an observant, religious Muslim woman, is not to be touched by a male, which is something that's very common to the Jewish faith as well, as you will know. And so what occurs is we ask the pregnant women not to come through the metal detector, but we actually ask them to wait until a female soldier can come, pull them around the metal detector, use the wand instead of having them walk through the metal detector, which is far less harmful, and then perform any further searches that need to take place. Now, there aren't as many female soldiers as there are male soldiers. But for example, that delay at a checkpoint, Mark, is out of deference to the religious faith of the individual walking through it. So the delay there is actually not a sign of inhumanity or humiliation, it's quite the opposite. It's a sign of sensitivity and it's a sign of cultural understanding. And just to make it clear, the reason that a lady may be delayed at a checkpoint is because those who are terrorists or who seek to carry out terrorist acts are not stupid. They're not foolish. They're not to be underestimated. And therefore, if there's contraband or if there are nails or ball bearings or ammunition that they want to transport into the Jewish area for the purposes of causing harm, they're not going to put that onto some muscular, bandana-wearing terrorist that one could identify from a mile away. They're going to place it beneath the clothing of a woman. And oftentimes they will try to make it look as though that woman is pregnant when actually she's not. So one of the things that we do is we don't just pull over every pregnant woman and delay them. We ask them to pull their clothing, which is usually very loose and flowing clothing, close to their form. And if at that point we see lumps and bumps that ought not to be there, then we will ask her to please wait. She's certainly not arrested. We will oftentimes provide her with a seat, we'll find shade for her, and then a female soldier will come along, and that individual will be processed around the medicine tent. So that's one example of what occurs there, just from the checkpoints. There are countless other examples. There are examples on the other side of the spectrum, by the way. I mean, I remember, Mark, growing up in the United Kingdom, and every time there was some sort of an event in the State of Israel, there would be pro-Israel Zionist Jews who would say, the IDF is going to go in there and they're going to smash them and they're going to win and this will be quick and easy. And I can tell you, you have to spend about 30 seconds in the uniform of a soldier next to other soldiers to realize that is not the mindset of a soldier of the IDF. It's not one of their options, it's not encouraged, and it's not something that they wish to pursue either. So both sides really have these misapprehensions about what the IDF is. And I'm very proud of my service, and I'm very proud of the soldiers I served alongside. That's checkpoints. I can give other examples as well.
I want to read to you from the manifesto of the Movement for Black Lives. This is what they are saying about the State of Israel, and specifically about the IDF, and I just want to hear how you would respond. In its alliance with Israel, the United States is complicit in the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people. Israel is an apartheid state with over 50 laws on the books that sanction discrimination against the Palestinian people. Palestinian homes and land are routinely bulldozed to make way for illegal Israeli settlements. Israeli soldiers also regularly arrest and detain Palestinians as young as 4 years old without due process. Every day, Palestinians are forced to walk through military checkpoints along the U.S.-funded apartheid wall. When you hear that, what thoughts come to your mind, Benjamin?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I'm very supportive of the idea of improving the methods and the modes of problematic police officers and rooting out problematic police officers that has really spawned greater awareness of the Black Lives Matter movement of late. And I want to be very clear about that. I'm talking about the bad apples within the police force, because I do not believe that the police force of the United States of America is filled with majority bad apples or rotten apples. It's not my experience with them. I don't think there's any reason to think that. But where cases, especially those as egregious as what we all bore witness to, occur, those people have to go and they have to be rooted out. And it's very good that we are now having a conversation about how best to do that. It's born of tragedy, but if something positive can come of it, it's to curb that type of an occurrence, and I hope that we do curb it. With that having been said, I don't excuse Black Lives Matter for singling out the Jewish people and the Jewish state for slander. I don't think you get a pass for that, and I'll give you an example of it. About 25,000 Jewish people marched across the Brooklyn Bridge in a show, a parade that, in my opinion, was given something of a misnomer for a title. I think it was called the No Fear, No Hate March. And it was actually something that was born precisely of hate towards the Jewish people and as a result of fear that was felt by the Jewish people. Now, if those Jewish people had turned around and said, we want to preserve the lives of the Jewish people who have now found themselves being fired upon in services while at the synagogue, in stabbings up in Muncie, who are being beaten in the streets of Brooklyn, and as part of our manifesto, we want to single out Black Americans, or we want to single out an African state, or we want to single out whomever it may be, a person, a place of color. You don't get a pass for that. It's not acceptable. Jewish people would not give a Jewish march like that a pass for saying something like that. And so when Black Lives Matter singles out randomly and exclusively the Jewish state, I think that that's completely unacceptable. And at that point, I have a duty to call that out and to say that they're applying a double standard to the Jewish people. Now, I also think that that is a result of the potency of the BDS movement. I think it's the result of the potency of what's going on college campuses with what's called intersectionality and so on and so forth. But in terms of the specific allegations, you know, for people to argue that there's an apartheid fence is for people to be ahistoric. The reality of the matter is that every single year, if we go back only as far as the year 2000, Hamas was carrying out bloody, brutal, murderous homicide bombings against innocent Israelis, incidentally Jewish and non-Jewish Israelis alike. Some of those that your listeners and viewers might remember with the Sparrow bombing in the pizzeria in Jerusalem. There was also a dreadful detonation at the Park Hotel on Seder night, on Leil HaSeder in Netanya. And we, of course, had the awful bombing of the Dolphinarium nightclub in Tel Aviv. So this went right across the state of Israel in a sustained fashion, launched by Palestinian Islamic Jihad, by Hamas, and yes, by Fatah. A lot of people look at Fatah as being some sort of moderate entity. They're not a moderate entity. What they are is an entity that has been blunted when it comes to wielding terror, precisely because the state of Israel in the year 2002, I believe, the cabinet made its decision that enough was enough, that enough Jewish blood had been spilled, that enough Israeli blood, not exclusively of the Jewish faith, had been spilled, and that they had to literally fence that off. And so a couple of things happened. First and foremost, Ehud Barak, who was the prime minister prior to that, Ehud Barak was actually voted out of the polls. You'll remember he was actively engaged in peace negotiations.
Absolutely.
Along the lines of land for peace. And Israelis didn't yield to terror. They didn't become disoriented by way of these attacks. What Israelis did was they cleaved instead to security. And that's where we saw Ariel Sharon, who was seen as a very strong representative of Israeli security because of his history and his achievements, come to the fore as the prime minister. And Sharon accelerated the building of a security barrier which traces the security considerations of the state of Israel. It is not a border. It's not a permanent border. It certainly is not an apartheid fence in any way, shape, or form. What it is, it's a barrier against murder. It's a barrier against terror. And to bear that out, between 2003 and 2006, was the most rapid point of construction of that security barrier. Beyond the year 2006, there has never been more than one homicide bombing launched against the state of Israel. Not one. That's the effectiveness of that border. And I'm very sorry to say this, but if anybody is of the opinion that the Jewish people should tear down that border, those people, wittingly or unwittingly, are dealing in the notion that it's okay to murder Jews, that it's okay to have Jews blown apart in the course of undertaking the perfectly ordinary, that in deference to what they falsely perceive to be an issue of civil rights, Jews should lose the ultimate civil right, which is, of course, the right to live. And I think that movements such as Black Lives Matter and anybody who has that within their manifesto need to be educated. I think they need to come to the state of Israel and see how we live and what our considerations were. And I find it particularly tragic, Mark, because if you look at the history of the civil rights movement, the Jewish people in the United States of America were always at the front and center alongside their African-American brethren. And so to have people who are now pushing forward the civil rights, the legitimate civil rights of Black Americans, now defame the Jewish state and by effect defame the Jewish community to a degree, I think is highly, highly, highly regrettable.
When you were serving in the IDF, mm-hmm. were there instances where you saw Israeli soldiers do things that troubled you?
I've had the pleasure of sitting at this table now, or at a virtual table with you before, and I remember that you've said to me that unless, you haven't said this directly, but you've said that there are viewers who will view my denial of that as undercutting my broader argument. It doesn't matter to me. I have never, ever served alongside a soldier who has undertaken something that I deem questionable. What I have questioned is the restraint, the wisdom of the restraint that I've seen in certain circumstances. And I want to give you an example of that. Second Lebanon War, 2006. One of the things that people may or may not know is that militaries move during the night and they shelter and hold up during the course of the day in order not to be identified. Now, we had 100 soldiers sheltering inside a home inside southern Lebanon. They'd marched all through the night, they'd made it to this house, and this house had been identified by Hezbollah operatives, and they were targeting it. They were targeting it with mortars and so on and so forth. Ultimately, nothing came of their efforts. But 100 soldiers were in that house. Those soldiers, tired, beaten down, exhausted, starving, dehydrated, they were not allowed to sit on the couches within that house. They were not allowed to in any way deface the contents of that home. They were not even allowed to relieve themselves within the, what they have is what's called a bulpkia. It's a hole almost in the ground. We were not even allowed to relieve ourselves in that. What we had to do, listen to this for restraint and humanity, is we had to relieve ourselves into enormous receptacles, 2, 3, 4 feet high. And then I, as the heavy machine gunner, with everything that was going on in southern Lebanon, Mark, would be called to gear up, to put on my gloves, to put on my helmet, to make sure I had ammunition in the gun, because I was going on a mission. And that mission, unbelievably, was to carry out, you know, I did other missions as well, but this mission was to carry out the receptacles that were now overflowing and to dispose of them outside of the house. Now, that is to take your life and the life of the other soldiers into mortal danger in order to extend your humanity to the homeowners who have unfortunately had to leave their home so that you can clear out terrorists from that area. That kind of humanity, that degree of deference to the ethics of the IDF is something that I can concede I did question, but I can also tell you with certainty that I emerged from that war with a very, very clear conscience and very proud, not only of my actions, but certainly of the actions of the soldiers alongside whom I served.
Thank you very much, Anthony. We're very proud of you. Okay, before we go to Miriam again, you have to take us through Our Soldiers Speak.
Yes.
Why did you form it? And in retrospect, as you look back, what was the level of success you felt Our Soldiers Speak achieved?
So I founded Our Soldiers Speak in a very ad hoc way in 2006, and it carried on. It really took form in 2008, 2009. So when I came back from the Lebanon War, the second Lebanon War, I literally crossed the border. We stepped into the State of Israel, and doing so really was just putting one foot in front of the other over a dividing line that was about 2, 3 feet high by that point. And I was elated, and I felt safe, and I felt secure. And my captain did the oddest thing. My captain separated us. All of the soldiers of my brigade were to go to one side, and I was to go to the other side. And he came up to me. His name is Matan, and I want to thank him for being such a great leader during that war. You know, it's an incredible thing. He was 24 years of age, Mark, responsible for the lives of 100 men. And he took them all into war, and he brought all of them home safely. That's an incredible feat for a young man. They own, people like that only grow in the State of Israel, in my opinion. Jews like that only grow in the State of Israel. And he said to me, Benjamin, I want you to go over there and sit and interview with a reporter from the Times of London. He wants to know not about the political take, not about what a commentator wants to say, but he wants to hear from somebody who's been there inside the battlefield, inside a war zone, about what's going on. And you've got a nice British accent, so you go and do it. And I actually refused. I said, I'm not interested in doing any such thing. I've just come back. I'm exhausted. I do not trust the British media on this point at all. Don't forget, of course, I'm from the land of the BBC. And I said, I'm not interested in doing so. It's a very personal issue. And frankly, it was somewhat traumatic. And he said to me, Benjamin, I'm not asking you. I'm ordering you. Go over there and sit for an interview. And so I did so. I quickly changed out of my uniform, put on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt of the unit. I still have photographs of this, incidentally. And I sat there for interview. And as I was being interviewed, it occurred to me that this really needed to be done. That there was a desperate, desperate need for precisely what my captain had somehow anticipated was needed, which was for somebody without the politics, without the politicking, without being a commentator from afar, to express and articulate precisely what was going on. And so Our Soldiers Speak was born. And that was the genesis of the organization. Now, I started to lecture in communities in Israel, and then I went back to the United Kingdom, Mark, to undertake a post-baccalaureate pre-medical year of study. So I had my BA in American History, Literature, and Politics. And my plan had been, prior to service, to flip that into what's called an LLB, which is the equivalent of a JD, approximately, here in the United States of America, which is a very common pathway for people to undertake.
You thought of becoming a lawyer.
Very much I thought of becoming a lawyer, and I was expected to become a lawyer, and it was thought that I might take over my father's practice back in the UK, for example. But as I saw the medics deal with the injured, I became very, very inspired by what I was beholding there. And I decided that I wanted a life where I could earn a living, not pursuing wealth, but earn a living, and much more importantly, feel that I had a sense of purpose. And I felt that the life of a physician or a surgeon might well provide me with that. And so I went back to the United Kingdom, and during the course of my studies, I actually would write to synagogues, Mark, and I would email them and ask them to let me speak on Shabbat about my experiences in the Israel Defense Forces. And during that year, I was working in what's called an old age home in the United Kingdom, the Morris Feynman Home in Manchester. And I would take my wages and I would actually pay for the train and for board if necessary in order to be able to turn up and speak in these synagogues. Now, I have started speaking. Please.
What was the message you wanted to share in the synagogues you were going to speak in UK?
The message that I wanted to share at that time, Mark, was absolutely categorically that they ought to be proud of the Israel Defense Forces, because the Second Lebanon War left many people traumatized. I'm not referring to the soldiers, I'm referring specifically to onlookers. There were all sorts of allegations about the heavy-handed measures undertaken by the IDF, but much more than that, there was this notion that even back then I railed against, that we'd somehow lost that war, and that we'd somehow gone into Lebanon, been unsuccessful inside Lebanon, and the state of Israel was now more embattled than ever before, and indeed we would have another round the year after. And I felt that that did not at all gel with my experience. Yes, soldiers starved. Yes, we were dehydrated. Yes, there were injuries. Yes, we lost 122 soldiers, each one a tragedy. But I challenge anyone to point to a war where such things don't occur. You know, nobody questions, for example, whether or not the Second World War was a victory for the Allies. I dare say you will not be able to point to a seminal battle or engagement where there wasn't trench foot or where there wasn't starvation and certainly death in a combat zone. These are attendant any war. And so I wanted to answer your question directly, to tell people they can be proud of the actions and the ethics of the Israel Defense Forces, and they can rest assured that the Israel Defense Forces is more than capable and has just proven itself capable once again of defending the one and only Jewish state and those who hold her dear to their hearts throughout the world. And I will say that though my opinion is a minority opinion, I become more and more convinced that I am of the correct opinion. Not because I served there, but when you consider the dynamic of the Middle East, to have quiet on that border from 2006 to 2020, with the very, very occasional exception, speaks to a phenomenally well carried out military campaign. And that was the message that I wanted to put across to people.
In essence, that's what Our Soldiers Speak became, yes?
Not exactly. It wasn't supposed to be an organization. And it wasn't Our Soldiers Speaking. It was called Our Soldiers Speak because that's the name that I came up with. But in actual fact, it was this soldier speaking. It was one guy going around trying to get the opportunity to speak because I felt very passionate about it. You should know, incidentally, I never intended to speak in synagogues. You remember the aversion that I had to sitting down with the Times of London reporter that I spoke about. Well, there was a synagogue in Leeds that had forgotten to mark Yom HaZikaron, Israel's Remembrance Day. It's where we remember not only the fallen soldiers but the victims of terror from within the state of Israel. And it's very traditional for a Zionist synagogue, which almost every synagogue in the United Kingdom is, to do something to mark Yom HaZikaron in the Shabbat prior to it. And they hadn't done so. And so out of a sheer need to really scrape the bottom of the barrel, they'd heard that I had served, they knew that I had served, and they asked me if I would come and speak. And I actually said I would not. I was not interested in doing it. I didn't want to do it because I felt a couple of things worked against me. First and foremost, I felt that the British accent made me an inauthentic spokesperson about matters relating to Israel. Oddly, that was my thought. Secondly, I felt that it was too personal. Thirdly, I didn't want to talk about it. I actually wanted to shut it down. I wanted to shut down those memories and press forward with my medical studies, this pre-medical year, if you like, that I was undertaking. And the last point is, and I hope you'll accept this, I was terrified of public speaking. In actual fact, I still am today. If you were to see me 2-3 minutes before I take to a podium, I'm very, very nervous, very, very anxious, and
you
very
never know.
Well, it happens to be the truth, and those who know me well know that that's definitely the case. And so I rejected the offer. My father came to me and he said, if you have been asked to do this, you have a duty to do it. You must do it. And he gave me a quick coaching lesson on how to present publicly. And by a quick coaching lesson, I mean, he took me to his synagogue and he put me at the podium there and he walked around the four corners of the synagogue and he kept saying, louder, louder, I can't hear you, louder. And that was essentially all of the coaching that I had, just not to speak into my beard, as the proverbial expression goes. And so I spoke for 15 minutes and I realized on that Friday night when I spoke that this really did need to be done, not just in Israel, but also in the synagogues in the UK. And so that's when I started, as I say, to book my own speaking engagements in synagogues in the United Kingdom. And there was an individual there who heard me speak, and he said, you know, Benjamin, the work that you're doing in England is important, but if you want to make a difference, you have to take this message to the United States of America. That's what he said. I had never considered going to the United States of America, never thought about it. And he said, not only do you need to do that, but we need to raise the funds for you to do that. Now, this is something I would like to speak about if we have time during the course of the conversation. The British Jewish community is not in any way, shape, or form as philanthropic as the American Jewish community. The American Jewish community is a phenomenon in terms of its giving, its investment in non-for-profit, for-purpose organizations. And so we didn't manage to raise funds. So ultimately, an individual bought my ticket and sent me to the United States of America, and I turned up to speak. I had one gig. It was at Lincoln Square Synagogue between Mincha and Maariv under the auspices of Rabbi Robinson. And when I say a gig, these were not paid events. I just meant I had the opportunity to speak. And it was a disaster. I blew it completely, a total disaster. It was between Mincha and Maariv, afternoon davening and post-Sabbath davening, post-Sabbath praying, when people eat the third meal of the Shabbat. And the rabbi came up to me, he was very generous, he said, the sponsor of this meal is going to eulogize his late father. He'll do that for about 5 minutes, but the remainder of the time, the 25 or 35 minutes that remains is all yours, and you should just feel very comfortable. Well, this gentleman ended up speaking for about 30 minutes about his late father, Zichrono Livracha. And I was looking at the clock and thinking, I just want to get out of this. And I was asked to come to the podium, and Rabbi Robinson said to me, you've got about 3 minutes, make your point, but don't go long. And I didn't know how to do that.
I understand.
I had no idea how to do that. And I ended up speaking, and I remember the rabbi was doing this and off in time. And I didn't stop. People started to get up and leave the room, and they went to Davin Maariv, and I ended up probably with about one or two people still left in the room. And it was a complete disaster. I mean, really the worst rendition of anything that anyone could have to say. And I telephoned my father afterwards and I said to him, this is not the right thing for me to do. I shouldn't have come here. Nobody wants to hear this story. And he said, steel yourself to this. Go and prepare something new and get back on your horse and do it once more. And I had a friend by the name of Ken Stone, he and his wife, Natalie Stone, who lived in Teaneck, New Jersey. They went to the synagogue of a Rabbi Stephen Przanski, if you know that synagogue.
It's I do.
A very well-known synagogue in Teaneck.
He's a very well-known rabbi.
He's a very well-known rabbi. And the Stones offered to let me stay in their home. And they were asking Rabbi Przanski to let me speak in the main synagogue. And frankly, and I don't blame Rabbi Przanski, I think more or less to close the issue, Rabbi Przanski said, you can speak in the young professionals minyan downstairs. So I took it. I went there. And at that young professionals minyan, I was given the balance of time. And there was an individual there by the name of Zivi Mendelson, who was visiting Teaneck from Englewood, New Jersey, the adjacent community. Zivi came up to me afterwards, and Zivi said that he was very much moved by my words, and he wants to start getting me into other congregations. And he said, do you have a card? And I did have a card, because one of the things that gentleman in England had said to me was, the Americans will give you an opportunity to show your abilities in a way that nobody else will. If you give them a business card, they will follow up with you. And so whenever I went to a synagogue, I had a stack, a huge stack of hundreds of business cards, and everybody with whom I came into contact would get a business card. Zivi followed up with me on Motzei Shabbat, and he contacted his relatives and friends in Cleveland and in Fairlawn, New Jersey, and in Baltimore, and you name it. Zivi started to become this lay manager, if you like, for my talks. But I still had this challenge, which was I was being sent around, but I had no money and I didn't have anywhere to live. The Stones would host me in Teaneck, New Jersey as a base. But what was chewing up the ability to stay in America, and by now I'd realized this needed to be done, was frankly the cost of renting a car. And an incredible story about the American Jewish community came about in that context. I gave a talk at a synagogue named Shomrei Torah in Fairlawn, New Jersey. It was a rabbi named Rabbi Yudin. And I talked to the podium and I said to him very nervously, Rabbi, how long do you want me to speak? I'll never forget his words. He said to me, Benjamin, you take as much time as you want. And I felt all of the pressure descend and all of the pressure leave me. And then he had me speak at a singles event. I was not there as a guest. I was there as a speaker. And it was at his house right after the services. And that Motzei Shabbat, I got a phone call from somebody I'd never met. Remember, I was handing out my business cards. And at the end of that phone, there was a gentleman who said, my name is Sim Herring. My brother Aaron Herring heard you at the singles event at which you spoke. I'm sure you have all of the funding and all of the backing that you need, so I'm not going to offer you that. But do you happen to need a car? Because I buy and sell cars. Amazing American Jew. Only in America do you find Jewish people like this individual. And I said, I remember my response was, Nafalta min ha-shamayim achshav, which means you've fallen from the heavens, almost like the Mashiach. And I said, yes, I need a car. And where can I come and pick it up? And I think he was living in the Bronx at the time. Right? He's a very interesting character, Sim Herring. And he said, come and meet me tonight and I'll give you the car and it's yours. I don't want anything for it. Just take it and do the work that you're doing. Well, he led me to this car. And Mark, it was a banged up, dented, dilapidated, bright red Pontiac Firebird. It had one hubcap. That hubcap was behind the passenger seat inside the car. The seatbelt was lax and loose. It no longer really worked. And I remember Sim actually walked around the car inspecting it so that he'd have a record of any damage that I might cause to it. And he said, it's yours, you take it. Now, this is an amazing story. He said, it's yours, you take it, but I just want you to know, even though the radio display, the stereo display doesn't work, I think that the stereo itself does work. So you won't be able to see what's on there, but you'll be able to hear music. And I wasn't bothered about that. And I thanked him and I got in the car and I started to drive back to Teaneck. And I turned on this stereo and I thought, let's see if Sim's going guess was correct. And out of that stereo came a song I'd never heard before, and to this day it remains my favorite song. It was Bruce Springsteen's Thunder Road. And I remember listening to Thunder Road in this Pontiac Firebird, and I thought to myself, I just might be in the right place at the right time, doing the right thing. And Sim Herring gave wheels to our organization. And the amazing thing about that car is that I slept in that car for many, many months on the road. I lived in that car. I ate in that car. I would plot, because back then there wasn't GPS, I would plot the route between the states on the hood of that car. I was pulled over by American sheriffs when I drove with a heavy foot in that car, who amazingly would turn around to me and say, "You're here, and you're speaking about Israel. God bless you, sir." And they would salute me and send me on my way. I mean, what a story about American jury, and I'll always be indebted to Sim, and I'll always be very grateful to him, more than him.
What a fabulous, fabulous story. Mm-hmm. Benjamin, we're going to have to pause right here at this point in the story. I want to continue with you next time. I want to hear the rest of the story. Again, I want to hear how you feel about our soldiers speak in retrospect, and then we'll talk about the Miriam Institute. So thank you for part one. You just rest. We'll continue in one moment. Again, that's my part one of my conversation with Benjamin Anthony. As always, I invite you to be in touch with me with any thoughts or comments you may have to the discussion so far. Please email me at rabbigolub@jbstv.org or write me at Post Office Box 360, Stamford, Connecticut, 06904. Also remember, there's now the L'Chaim podcast. Download the L'Chaim podcast. Take us with you wherever you go. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. L'Chaim, my friends, to life.
L'Chaim is a presentation of Jewish Education in Media.
We would be pleased to send a complimentary DVD of this program to anyone who wishes to support JBS with a tax-deductible gift of $36, double chai, or more. Simply visit the JBS website at jbstv.org and click on the Donate button to make a donation by PayPal or your credit card. And please indicate the program for which you would like a DVD. Or you can send your tax-deductible check to JBS, Post Office Box 360, Stamford, Connecticut 06904. Or you can call the JBS Pledge Line at 833-MY-JBS-TV. That's 833-695-2788. And again, please remember to indicate which program you would like to receive with our compliments. We thank you for your kind support.